Welcome to IP Protection Matters. I'm your host, Renee Giacchino. Today we are joined by Wayne Weingarten. Wayne joins us. He is a senior fellow in business and economics at the Pacific Research Institute, and he's director of the Center for Medical Economics and Innovation. To follow his work and the work of the Pacific Research Institute, you can check him out at pacificresearch.org. Among other topics, today we'll be talking with Wayne about the economic implications of regulatory policies and how price controls undermine patents and intellectual property protections. Wayne, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you join me.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So before we dive into these important issues, I thought I'd give you a moment to tell us a little bit about what you're currently working on at Pacific Research Institute.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're working on many things. We cover education, California issues, healthcare, energy, the environment. So we cover a wide range of issues. Personally, I'm following what's happening in Sacramento. We've just passed our budget, so we're closely following all the different spending initiatives and the special session as well.
Very good. Well, I want to start by talking about a piece that you recently wrote where you outlined how Senator Bernie Sanders' highly publicized press release where he's proposing price controls will ultimately harm patients. Can you elaborate on this for us?
Absolutely. I think it's important to remember when we're talking about healthcare, and when we focus a lot on the patients who are trying to afford medicines, and that's a very, very important issue. But what's also just as important is that there are a lot of patients out there that don't have efficacious treatments that are waiting for that miracle cure to be developed. And so when we talk about price controls, when we start taking away the ability of the companies who develop the medicines to cover the cost of capital, and that's a really essential concept, the cost of capital. If we can't cover that, then we're not going to have the incentive to develop new medicines. And so people living with Alzheimer's, people who are living with muscular dystrophy, people who are living with pancreatic cancer, they're not going to have the ability to have those treatments developed. That hope is being taken away. And that was one of the things that I really wanted to emphasize, and I think it's an important part of the conversation, is that there are many people who are patients waiting for these cures, and we need to think about them as well.
So when we talk about the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which was passed back in August 2022, and they've recently released the list of the different medicines that will in fact be subject to these types of policies, the drug price controls, it effectively imposes those price controls on a portion of the pharmaceutical market. And worse, by design, the reach of these price controls is going to expand every single year. Certainly, you have already talked about the intended consequences of this policy and what they hoped would be to reduce overall spending on the drugs. What are the unintended consequences of these regulations in addition to the lack of innovation?
Well, first, I think it's important to note that our price system is very, very complicated. And so in terms of the intended consequence, the list price, which is what the benchmark that people always refer to, and that's what we see, isn't the actual net price, the price of all the discounts and rebates that's paid into the system. And so when you actually look at the negotiations in terms of what developed, it actually wasn't that far off from the discounts that were actually already being kind of through the system as very complicated, but were already being negotiated. So in terms of the initial outcomes, the negotiations really didn't create any new savings at all. And so what you're then doing, though, is you're impacting, again, beyond just that innovation aspect, you're changing the way companies are going to be pricing. You're changing for the worse, so you're creating more perverse incentives, which could lead to, in some ways, higher prices earlier on in order to get different types of revenues. You're changing companies' incentives to continue to look for additional uses of medicines. Or once a medicine has been approved, companies continue to do what's called post-marketing research, trying to figure out how can we make the medicine better, how make the side effects more moderate. How can we bring this to more conditions? And so you're also taking away the incentives to expand the benefits of the medicine. So you have all those different types of unintended consequences that are all to the kind of the adverse outcomes for patients.
So how do you respond to Senator Sanders' claim that the exclusivity period is enabling pharmaceutical companies to earn excessive profits?
Well, the first thing I would say is if Senator Sanders is saying that we need to address the IP system, we need to address kind of how that works. There's, I think, a lot of important reforms that we can look at that can improve how that system functions, especially because right now, when you get your initial protection or your initial exclusivity period, you're not on market. So you're losing more than half of your exclusivity period during the time when you're actually developing drug and getting regulatory approval. So I think there is absolutely improvements that should be made that create greater certainty in terms of the investment, as well as greater certainty in terms of when competition comes into play, because that's a very essential kind of element or kind of social compact that we're talking about, that the innovators get that exclusivity period to get the opportunity, not a guarantee, it's an opportunity to cover the cost of capital. But once that opportunity has been provided, we need to foster in competition. So in terms of IP system, absolutely, we can improve it. Now, when you're talking about excessive profits, I mean, what's very funny when you throw out terms like excessive profits or fair is that those are relative terms. And so we're never actually kind of defining what actually is kind of that benchmark that you're looking at. And when you start then digging into it, you start realizing that most drugs fail, mm-hmm. right? So that when one drug finally gets to market, and it's finally available to patients, and then, of course, you have the market outcome, right? Many drugs will come to be available to patients, and they're not that big of a seller. The doctors don't prescribe them. The efficacy isn't really what people would look at, and so they're not used so much. So when you finally get a drug that then gets through the FDA and has high demand, you've got a lot of costs and a lot of failures that you have to compensate for. And so that's what you're talking about. When you actually look at the return on equity of pharmaceutical companies and biopharmaceutical companies compared to the market, now we're getting into the cost of capital issues, it's not that extraordinary. The pharmaceutical companies are not making excessive profits when you look at risk-adjusted return on equity, because you're talking about 10 to 15 years, $3 billion to develop a drug. That's a very long, risky endeavor. The pricing is trying to compensate for all of that. And then when you look at the actual financial returns, it's very normal for the rest of the market, which means that you're able to attract the capital for those investments. And if you didn't meet those benchmarks, you wouldn't attract the capital, we wouldn't have the opportunity to get those treatments.
If my memory serves me right, I think I read somewhere that only about 10% of these drugs actually make it through the lengthy trials and to market. And as you said, innovators can spend on average upwards of $2.5 to $3 billion with a B developing these new medicines over the course of 10 to 15 years. So I think it's not surprising that generic companies can produce drugs cheaper, than the company who created the medicine originally can. But let's take it outside of the pharmaceutical arena, because this isn't just happening with drugs and in the pharmaceutical arena. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, these are issues that all sorts of industries are dealing with, and they're going to vary by industry. If you go into the IT and technology, you have a different IP issue because there are so many patents, inside the iPhone or inside the technology, and that creates all sorts of different complexities. So, absolutely, one of the really difficult things about being a cutting edge knowledge economy that the U.S. economy is addressing all of these very important IP issues that become more and more complicated as technology becomes more and more advanced.
So let's go back to your, I don't know that I can call it your home state, but where you're currently living for sure, California, where the Pacific Research Institute is located, and even more specifically, Silicon Valley, which has long been known as the home of many, maybe even most of America's greatest startups. I think, certainly the data is out there. You're already facing high taxes, burdensome state regulations, high crime rates. They've driven many of these startups out of the state of California. What impact do you think the continued threats to IP protection is going to have on California generally, and more specifically on its economic situation?
Well, the IP threat is a national threat. So it's something that, you know, is certainly it's going to affect Austin, Texas, as much as it's going to impact San Jose, California. So, I mean, that is something, of course, nationally that's there. But in terms of California, when you have an additional burden, and that's one of the things you see, and it's not just Silicon Valley, but we're focusing on Silicon Valley now. It's very much a death of a thousand cuts in terms of driving a lot of the companies out, right? It's not just that taxes are exceptionally high in California. I mean, we have a top rate of 13.3%. It's, you know, it's not just that housing costs are expensive. You know, it's all of these combined. Gas is, you know, $6 a gallon. I mean, so it's everything combined. And so when you have the IP difficulties on top of that, that additional risk, it changes kind of that relative price. And so it's going to impact California more simply because in addition to that risk, you have all of the other costs that you have to deal with, which just can, on the margin, just encourage someone to be in Austin, where while you still have those IP risks, that kind of the relative kind of relative to all the other risks that you're bearing is lower. And so, you know, it's just in a sense another encouragement to leave, because if the IP is going to hit you, you're better off in Austin than you are in San Jose. So it's adding another burden on top of all of our self-created or self-inflicted problems that just creates another kind of relative disadvantage, even though it's hitting the country evenly, because of kind of the state of where we're currently starting compared to all these other places.
Let's talk about another burden, the ill effects from abusive lawsuits. Those are also well documented. They include higher costs for consumers, reduced economic output. What impact have you seen those lawsuits have on innovation?
Well, I mean, they've had terrible impact. And that's even, I mean, look at ExxonMobil, right, where the state of California, we're suing them because of global climate change, and we're suing them because of plastics. And so that impacts in a lot of ways. One, it's a diversion of resources, right? If I'm spending money and defending a lawsuit, I'm not investing in technologies, you know, in a case, you know, better drilling techniques, cleaner drilling techniques, you know, carbon sequestration or low emission sources. I mean, all sorts of those types of benefits, right? If you're spending money on lawsuits, you're not devoting resources towards those efforts. But I think even more troubling is that you're also changing the incentives of the organization. You're making the organization itself more risk averse. And so innovation comes from not just sweat, not just brilliance, but it, you know, comes from taking risks. And so when you start kind of increasing the costs of risk taking, you're going to reduce the amount of risks people are willing to take or organizations are willing to take, especially large organizations. So you're actually kind of dampening that innovative environment. And when you look at Silicon Valley, right, an environment that's the whole kind of economic mantra is taking risks and, you know, swinging for the fences and seeing if you can be the next Apple and the next NVIDIA, you know, whatever, you know, artificial intelligence. That type of kind of additional litigation risk, it just is an additional dampening. You know, with the caveat that obviously the people who have been harmed need to be able to have redress through the courts, right? If you've stolen somebody's IP, we need IP protection, and you should have access to the courts to rectify that. You know, same thing with injury. We need legitimate claims to go through, but it's the over litigious. It's AG Bonta suing Exxon over plastic, even though, you know, the state's been aware of and, you know, using the recycle programs and part of the process the whole time. It's that type of disingenuous lawsuit abuse that harms the innovative environment.
Excellent points. I appreciate you delving further into those. One final question for you. President Biden recently announced a new program and funding for research on cancer surgeries as part of his administration's Cancer Moonshot Initiative aimed at reducing cancer deaths. And those proposed price controls and the other efforts that we've been talking about in the beginning of our conversation that undercut patents and their incentives, won't they work contrary to this whole Cancer Moonshot Initiative?
Yes. It's the right hand working against the left hand. So, one thing I think it's really important to recognize when we're talking about the pharmaceutical innovations and the biologics and hopefully the gene therapies that are coming down the pike is that the government does important basic research, right? And that is an important role for the government, is to do that kind of that basic research that can't be commercialized. The government is very lousy at commercializing research, or taking an idea or a notion or a scientific discovery and turning that into a usable, in this case, a usable therapy, a usable medicine. On top of it, the private sector spends significantly more money developing kind of the treatments than what the government is spending on. I mean, what the government is spending on basic research writ large, let alone the basic research that it's spending that's devoted to the biopharmaceutical space. And I bring all of that up because now we're talking about the cancer moonshot. And we're saying the government wants to push that forward, but at the same time, it's pushing down on the private sector so that the actual institutions that would take different ideas that the government might come up with and turn them into those cancer treatments, we're actually hobbling those while we're spending more money on the government side. So it's a very ineffective policy. It turns what should be a very valuable resource into something that can very well turn into just waste, fraud, and abuse. You know, that comment we always hear about government spending, because we're actually hampering the process that turns kind of that core public good into kind of the ultimate product that we want in this case, which is the research or the treatments for or more treatments for cancer.
Well, then you couple that with the administration pushing these march-in rights as another form of price control. And again, the significant impact, the threat that it is going to have on innovation, on furthering IP protection, you know, just magnified.
And I think it's magnified outside of just the biopharmaceutical space too. And I think that's mm-hmm. something important, not just to recognize, but for other companies to recognize too, that while they're talking about marching rights now with respect to drugs, that it's very easily, once you have that kind of precedent set, for that to move into other industries. Well, this technology becomes very, very important for national defense, so we're going to have a marching right there. I mean, so this is a very slippery slope that we're playing with, which has incredible important implications for health, but it goes much broader than that, too. So it is a very troubling trend.
Well, Wayne, we thank you so much for all the work that you are doing on this issue, helping to educate us and educate anyone else who will listen. Our guest has been Wayne Weingarten, Senior Fellow in Business and Economics at the Pacific Research Institute. He's also the Director of the Center for Medical Economics and Innovation. Wayne, thank you for your time today. We'd love to have you join us again sometime.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.